Please be seated.
Re-examination, Mr. Winchester. No, I haven't asked them yet.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
We'll get to ours. It's just neater to actually your re-exam and then the court's questions and anything following on.
That's fine, ma'am. Thank you. Just one matter, I think. Ms. McIntyre, and my learned friend, Mr. Page, asked you some questions about the compulsory values in the NPS.
Yes.
Particularly focusing on threatened species. Do you recall those questions?
Yes.
I wonder if you could open up the NPS to Appendix 1A.
Yes.
And let's just go to the threatened species section there in terms of that compulsory value. Can you read the second sentence?
All the components of ecosystem health must be managed, as well as, if appropriate, specialised habitat or conditions needed for only part of the life cycle of the threatened species.
Yes. So when you think about the, as I understood the suggestion, that limits could be set through consents for the protection of galaxids in particular, and that would be a way of getting on and giving effect to the NPS. When you read that direction as a whole, what does that tell you about the effectiveness of that method?
Well, it tells me that it's not enough, which I think is where I was sort of trying to head, I think, in terms of explaining my...
Yes. And if you look at another compulsory value in Appendix 1A, for example, Mahinga Kai number 4.
Yes.
Is it possible that a threatened species could also be categorised as, or fall under categorisation of Mahinga Kai? Can you?
Yes, I think in particular in terms of tuna species, eel species, is an obvious one.
Yes, right. And also thinking about other compulsory values in Appendix 1A, and in particular, ecosystem health.
Yes.
So, just taking a step back, is it your understanding, or what's your understanding as to giving effect to these compulsory values? Do you have to give effect to them individually or collectively?
Well, I think the approach of the NPS is not to try and partition things, that it is intended to take a more holistic approach.
Yes. So you'll see there the second sentence, or the second paragraph under number 1, ecosystem health, says there are 5 biophysical components that contribute to freshwater ecosystem health, and it is necessary that all of them are managed. What do you understand by the meaning of necessary in terms of its level of directiveness?
Well, it's very directive.
Yes. And in terms of the questions you were asked about threatened species, can you identify which of the 5 biophysical components might also be relevant to setting a framework or achieving protection of threatened species?
I would expect that they all would be.
No, thank you, Ms. McIntyre. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Questions you could help me with. Thank you. So, early on you asked a question in terms of what you meant by not compromising the new land and water plan. And one of the elements you suggested was that you shouldn't be granting consents beyond the life of the new framework. So I just want to tease that out a little bit. So what year were you taking as it being likely that the new framework would become operative?
I understand that it's intended to notify the plan in 2023 and for it to become operative by 2025.
Right. So I just now want to look at that in terms of the change. Well, it might not be a change, but in your summary you talked about 10 years maximum term, and I think somewhere sort of early on in all this paperwork, 2035 was added to the non-complying activity policy. I think it was. That was a long time ago. I just want to understand the rationale for your 10 years.
I think in my evidence in chief, I had suggested that 2035 be shifted to 2030.
That's my memory. Yeah. Yes.
My rationale for 10 years as the maximum is that whether the regional plan sticks with the statutory 10-year cycle or whether it extends longer, if we set an outside limit of 10 years, then we can be confident that those consents will come up for replacement within the life of the plan rather than beyond it. So essentially that is given that what we were at now is ahead of that plan being notified and becoming operative. So if you take 10 years from now for consents that are being granted this year, that would mean that they would come up for reassessment halfway through the land and water plan supposed life cycle. If they are coming in a year or two's time, then obviously that would be a little bit later, but it would still be within that 10-year time frame.
So in terms of some of the framework, you have the 6 years, don't you?
Yes.
So you've got 6 years and then you've got 10 years.
Yes.
And in terms of implementation of the new framework, there's the 6-year consents potentially, there could be 10-year consents, and there's a whole lot of other ones that have got potentially longer terms.
Yes.
So you're wanting to get them on a catchment basis. All at least coming under your section 128 process that allows you to consider them all in some way. We won't go into what you can and can't do under the 128 thing, but if we just consider it in the straight process, considering the catchment terms, how do you see all of that working?
It's a little hard to look forward in terms of how it is all going to work because there's so many bits coming together, and there are, we do have this situation, as you say, we've got some very long-term consents that have been granted and now we're looking at shorter-term ones. I think ideally it would be good to have catchment-based reviews during the life of the land and water plan. As I've said, I think there are limits as to what can be achieved through those reviews, and that if the consents are coming up for replacement within the life of the plan, then that means you can deal with the things that a consent review can't deal with. I also, my experience is also that while regional councils might have great intentions to review everything on a review all their consents on catchment basis, often things get in the way of doing that, so it doesn't always happen. Whereas if a consent expires, then it has to be looked at again. So I think that provides a bit of a fail-safe. As to how it all works together, I think it's going to take some planning, and there's also going to be some work needing to be done in the regional council to try and assess what's the sort of pattern of incoming, I suppose, in terms of when various things might be coming up for renewal, how and what priorities there should be in terms of planning catchment-based reviews. I don't have a good enough overview of what the consenting situation is as a whole to be able to shed a whole lot of light on how that might work at this stage.
But the really important thing is you can have all the plans that you like, but if then what's happened and might be happening in the consenting space can undermine plans or not progress the outcomes that have been set in plans and that sort of thing. So how do you think what you're suggesting with the 6 years and 10-year timeframes might relate to that?
Okay. Well, the 6-year controlled activity space, I mean, those consents will come up for renewal essentially when the new plan is notified, so they can be looked at in terms of that new framework. Essentially, they would be, you know, first off the block in terms of trying to implement the new framework. There would be gaps. There might be some significant gaps. But that would be getting underway. Now, in terms of the 10-year ones, well, I mean, 10 years is outside. They may be granted for 10 years, they may be granted for something between 6 and 10 years. I know in the current version, because there's a clear policy directive for 6 years, then that 10 years has fallen away.
But suggesting bringing it back.
Well, I'm not necessarily suggesting bringing it back. What I'm suggesting is that if another time frame in addition to the 6 years is brought in, it should not be longer than 10 years. That's essentially what I'm suggesting. I think in terms of the current version that we're looking at, I don't think we need that additional time. I don't think we need an additional outer time frame to be there, as long as we have the policy clear enough as to what the intent is, which is essentially why I suggested that wording in terms of ensuring that the effectiveness of the new planning framework isn't undermined, because that's what we're trying to achieve. I thought if we have a clear direction as to that, then we don't need that out of time, because part of not undermining the new framework is, you know, that you don't have consents that extend beyond it now. We've had the discussion about whether it might be helpful to actually make that clearer in terms of the outcomes that are being sought by this plan change. My comment today about, you know, still sticking to that 10-year outside was really in terms of if there is the possibility of something like Ms. Dicey's new pathway being put in, then I don't think that that should have any time frame longer than 10 years. So that was in that. So, and if it was in that circumstance, then if that was to happen, then those consents presumably would be coming in at some time between the 6 and 10 years and would be assessed in terms of the new framework at that point.
So if we put that one to one side and go back to the council version with its strong signal about 6 years for everything, or some things, I think some new waters been suggested that should come in as well, completely new consents.
Yep.
That would mean that you'd have a whole lot more people coming up early on under the new plan for renewal.
Yes, that's right.
And would you see any benefits to that?
Well, if the earlier they come up within the new framework, then the quicker that we are going to be able to get on with implementing the MPS, essentially. So I do see an advantage in terms of that. There would have to be some planning in terms of managing the work, but I do see a benefit in terms of achieving what the MPS is intending to achieve.
Yes, so there may be some resourcing questions about that. You don't know the answer to that, but then there are resourcing questions about what's happening now.
There are.
Look, thank you for that.
I've just got a couple of questions about your evidence, and a third question in particular about Te Mana o Te Wai and the decision that the court needs to make. So just turning back to your evidence, you said that among kaitahi, there is a school of thought that says that the focus of protection on a single Indigenous species has been used to the detriment of the broader or wider environment. So other species, I've noted you said other freshwater species have been sacrificed. And I was just wondering if you could tease it out a little based on your own experience.
The example that I was thinking of, which isn't my experience but something that's been relayed to me by one of the Runaka representatives that we work with, essentially it was a similar sort of situation, I suppose, to the to the tension between trout and galaxids, except that in this case the perceived predator was tuna.
Tuna.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Tuna's the predator on galaxids.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So in this example that I had described to me, a stream that was being managed for galaxids was being managed to the detriment of tuna because it was being managed for the galaxids, and also specifically because tuna were seen as predating, potentially predating on the galaxids.
All right. Any other examples in your... It doesn't have to be necessarily examples tied back to kaitahi, but just any other examples in your planning experience?
Well, I think the examples... can I come up with a specific example? There are examples I'm aware of where a focus on... protecting a particular tributary for a particular species essentially means that other tributaries get traded off against that one. And that is one of the, as in terms of the kaitahi approach of looking at the system as a whole, that's something that they don't find acceptable.
So attention gets diverted, if you like, if you're nominating species for protection.
It's a little bit going back, showing my age, going back to the old days of wise use.
Yeah.
So if you're saying this is the best use for this stream or this tributary, and therefore we will manage it for this, and therefore that means we can use these other streams for something else and not worry about, you know, I suppose, underlying values that there might be because this is the best use for this one. It's that sort of approach that is problematic.
And that would be moving away from that kiuta kitai approach.
That's right.
Fundamentally what underlines that objection to that approach.
Yes.
Okay. So that was the first question. I was interested in, it's probably an answer to Mr. Page, you were saying, well, if you leave it all up, if you leave the attainment of the land and water plan outcomes, so this is the plan, future plan, to review condition, what you risk is that there will be initiatives in that land and water plan which are not amenable to review. And the illustration you gave is if the initiative is to change a point of take, and I reflected back, is that aligned with your evidence, which is no longer taking water off the tribs but taking them off the main stem, and you said yes.
Yes.
Were there any other initiatives, again, that you're aware of that could be brought to bear but not amenable or readily amenable to review of consent?
That's the most obvious one. I mean, I think there are potential other ones in terms of things like use of off-stream storage potentially, or potentially even some of the sorts of, I suppose, developments of water sharing type approaches could possibly fall into that boat. I haven't had a chance to think about it too hard. And we're only at the beginning of the process of developing the new framework. But I think, I suppose, my point is I think there are going to have to be some creative solutions. We don't want to limit the ambition of those. And there are certainly, you know, there are that just relying on reviews of consents might limit the ability to implement those.
When I was brainstorming, I was taking notes on what you were saying. I actually noted water storage as being a potential example, and you've confirmed that it is an example. And is that because, you know, if the new initiative is that there needs to be more on-farm or community water storage for the primary sector, you can't review an existing consent and say, you go ahead and apply for that activity. It doesn't work that way.
Well, a consent relates to a point of take.
Mm.
So if you shift that point of take, particularly if you shift it to a different water body, you're talking about a new consent, understanding.
Yeah. And so the same with the water storage. If you're developing water storage, potentially that's a new consent or a whole suite of consents for that water storage. And the difficulty with the review condition in both those examples is that you can't make people apply for resource consent. And so that's where the initiative starts to go to ground.
That's right. Yeah. So that you're limited then to trying to implement the new plan to the extent with which you can within the framework of that existing consent.
Mm. Some other initiatives perhaps you could implement, like land use rules associated with management, or rather the use of nutrients. You could perhaps rule that up, maybe?
That's an interesting question. Mm. I think that would depend on the scope of the consent.
Mm.
If your consent is only for water take, then I guess...
Oh, I see.
I imagine it would it would depend on how the new framework frames it, whether... And the connection that is made in the new framework between those aspects.
No, I understand what you're saying. Okay, right. No, that was the second question. Third question was this. So court's got to make a decision. And one of the things that I've put out there in some of my questions, but I'm going to ask you directly, is, well, how do you make that decision where it's not... being suggested that PC7 is... implementing to a full extent or even partial extent the MPS for fresh water. So that's, you agree with that proposition?
Yes.
Yep. And nevertheless, my proposition is, and I wanted to hear from you about this, the fundamental concept, Te Manawarau-te-Wai, Clause 1.3 applies.
Yes.
And is to be brought into consideration by the court when deciding which of the myriad of different approaches we're to take. Would that be fair?
Yes.
So it's applying, at least at its broadest level, to inform our discretionary judgment. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
What I was less clear about is whether that is also true for the objective 2.1. And so, for example, if we are to regard this plan change as a breathing space,
mm-hmm.
might we not say that that breathing space is what is required now to ensure that the natural and physical resources are managed in a way that prioritises, and then you've got the three priorities?
That's how you look at it? Yes.
Yeah. So this is what's required now. It is not the full implementation or even a partial implementation, but actually doing nothing is what is required at this point in time to achieve, you know, to ensure that natural and physical resources are managed in this way.
It's allowing the time for the planning to go on for that approach that gives effect to Te Manawarau-te-Wai.
Yeah.
Without things going past us.
Yes. So some might say, well, that's an action, and the other way of looking at it, actually, that's positive action to enable the Regional Council to get itself in a position where it can fully implement this plan through a new plan.
Yes.
And the other way of looking at it, if you're just looking at the ORAG case, but there are other cases, they would say, presumably, that taking remedial action now to protect freshwater ecosystems and threatened species and halting or reversing degradation is also what is required now to ensure natural and physical resources are managed in a way that prioritises. You know, so, and you're agreeing with that? They could say that?
I'm agreeing that they say that, yes.
They say that, yeah, okay. And so the judgment that the court makes is a judgment in the context that it's of fundamental importance. It is of fundamental importance of water. It's always in the context of Te Manawarau-te-Wai as articulated by Clause 1.3. And it's the judgment that we make is which is the best way to achieve the full implementation of the objective itself. Yeah, by either taking action or taking the action of allowing a breathing space.
Yes.
I think, thinking out loud. Yeah.
And I think the extent to which the let's take remedial action now approach works towards giving effect to Te Manawarau-te-Wai depends to a large extent on how broadly that is applied and how holistically it's applied. Mm. So if you're doing that on a number of individual applications, then I don't think it contributes much. If we did have a situation where it was being done on a catchment by catchment basis, then I think there would be a much stronger argument for that approach. My understanding at the moment is the closest we get to, I mean, I must say that I only have a very low level of familiarity with things like the Lindis, but in terms of what we're dealing with at the moment, the Manuhiri Care is the closest we get to in terms of that. I understand from Ms. Gilroy's evidence that there are actually very few circumstances in which we are dealing with anything like a whole catchment approach. So I think short of that whole catchment approach, I don't know how much that remedial action now really does contribute to that integrated management holistic approach of Te Manawarau-te-Wai.
Okay. All right. those are my questions. No questions. So those are the court's questions. Is there anything arising from that? Nothing? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. McIntyre. Now back to you, Mr. Page or Ms. Irving.
Yes, I'll call Mr. Dean Olson. I should say Dr. Olson, actually. Sorry.
Did you want to swear on the Bible?
FM.
Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truly declare and affirm this in matter now before the court to speak the truth, and truly nothing but the truth?
I do. That's right. Hasn't been over-allocated. Go on, thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. Olson. If your full name is Dean Anthony Olson.
It is.
And you are the owner and operator of Freestone Freshwater, a freshwater science consultancy in Dunedin.
Yep, that's correct.
You have prepared a brief of evidence in relation to this case, dated 5 February
2021. I have.
Now, do you have any amendments that you wish to make to that evidence?
I'd like to make two corrections.
Certainly, you'd like to take us through those.
Okay, so at paragraph 46, on page 18, talking about the Roxburgh Dam and Clyde Dam, and the last sentence of that paragraph says, this means that there has been no natural recruitment to areas upstream of Lake Roxburgh, and I'd just like to add in, since the construction of Roxburgh Dam was completed.
Now, it may be something or it may be absolutely nothing. Your paragraph 46 is on my page 20, not page 18, so hopefully that's not a problem in terms of drafts.
Yeah, well, it's the same as page 20 on my version too. I suspect it's probably a margins issue.
It'll be a margin thing on my printer.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. No, it's not
yeah. I'll work off the paragraph numbers and hopefully that will get us through. The other correction is at paragraph 56. I'm talking about the state of the environment, water quality monitoring network and trend reporting. There I say, in addition to 5 yearly state and trend reporting, ORC prepares annual water quality reports for all major catchments, summarising the results of the last 5 years of water quality and... Oh, no, actually, no, no, sorry, no, scratch that, just keep that as a... Sorry, I thought I cocked that up, but...
It's okay.
So no further amendments?
Yeah, no further amendments.
Thank you. So can you please confirm that that evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yeah, I do.
Now, can I ask you please to just take us through your summary of key points? And I have a couple of questions for you before I leave you with my friends.
Okay. Thank you. ORC undertakes extensive SOE monitoring of water quality, periphyton, habitat, macroinvertebrates and fish, which was reviewed by NIWA in 2017. ORC has also undertaken catchment studies and targeted investigations to gain more detailed information, particularly in catchments with high levels of water allocation and deemed permits. It is my opinion that there is sufficient, although not perfect, scientific basis for identifying freshwater values for most of the key water bodies in Otago that have deemed permits, scratch waters, and high levels of allocation. Many of New Zealand's most endangered species of freshwater fish are found in Otago, and many of these are only found in Otago. Trout pose the single greatest threat to non-migratory galaxids, many of which are threatened. The key factor affecting the distribution and abundance of longfin eels in the Clutha Mata'au catchment are the dams at Roxburgh and Clyde, and the creation of hydroelectric power dams has has created habitat for landlocked kauaro, which can also detrimentally affect threatened non-migratory galaxids. A wide range of factors affect the ecosystem health of Otago waterways. Whilst water allocation is one, factors such as the presence of pest species, such as didymo, introduced species, such as trout, also significantly affect the ecosystem and its response to changes in management. The water quality information presented in Professor Skelton's report was, in my view, fragmentary and in some cases inaccurate. Water quality in some areas is affected by contemporary irrigation practices, such as flood irrigation, but the process to replace water permits in such areas has the potential to result in improvements in water quality. Minimum flows and residual flows are the key tools to protect in-stream values from the effects of water abstraction. I do not see much scientific purpose being achieved by delaying the setting of limits as is proposed by PC7.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. Now, I'd just like to ask you a couple of questions in relation to the supplementary evidence from Ms. Everett Hinks and also Antonis Snelder. Do you have those briefs of evidence available?
I do. I've just got to find it.
Now, Ms. Everett Hinks and her supplementary evidence responds to some of your own evidence in chief, but I'd particularly like to talk about the comment she makes at her paragraph 14. So if I can just take you there. And here she's talking about the information that the council hold and explains that it currently doesn't explain the environmental issues, including their causes and location. Now, based on your own knowledge and understanding about environmental issues associated with freshwater and so on in Otago, would you agree with her evidence in that paragraph?
No, I wouldn't.
Could you perhaps explain to us why not?
Okay, so during my time working as a water resource scientist and later as the manager within the ORC, I used a number of sources of information that provided that sort of the sort of information about pressures that Dr. Everett Hinks is talking about. In particular, in terms of land use, we have the land cover database, which is regularly updated with different land cover classes, and those cover classes are consistent between the different versions of the land cover database. So if you see a change in that, you can actually attribute that to a change in land use, not just a different methodology between the two versions. We also had AgriBase, which was a GIS database that provided information on the type of land use. So the land cover would cover things, would give you information on things like this is the vegetation type, whereas the AgriBase would give you this is a sheep and beef farm, or this is a sheep farm, or this is a dairy farm, that sort of thing. So it sort of gives complementary information to the land cover database. And then on top of that, we had these catchment studies that we did, and we prioritised those in part to do with the deemed permit renewals and trying to understand what the consequences of those the changes associated with that might be. And that was those studies. So you have your broader State of the Environment Monitoring Network that's looking at a regional scale. Those sort of finer grained reports were going into specific catchments in most cases and sampling essentially in between the SOE sites. So you're expanding the SOE sites the information within the catchment to try and understand, you know, whether there were processes in particular sub-catchments that might be arising to undesirable water quality outcomes, for example. So that might allow you to identify natural processes within those catchments, such as high sediment loads coming out of mountainous areas. It might, if you have a sub-catchment with a site in it that has a lot of flood irrigation, you'd pick the consequences up of that. And then as you go down through along the main stem of the river, you might look at, you might be able to get a handle on groundwater inputs and what the consequences of that is. So I don't agree that council doesn't have information to be able to explain the environmental issues. I think that with experience, and there's certainly enough experience in the building at the moment, I think you can make a pretty fair stab as to what the pressing issues are.
Thank you. And does that information also allow us to interpret the analysis that was provided in the evidence filed by Antonis Snelder?
Yes, to a large extent. I mean, you're always going to get the oddball, curveball thrown at you. But I considered the information that in Dr. Snelder's evidence, and there weren't too many where I was scratching my head wondering what might be the driver of what he saw in his analysis.
So can you perhaps, I suppose we go to Dr. Snelder's evidence. And if my memory serves me correctly, he specifically says that that the report they'd provided didn't provide any interpretation of the results. But I wonder if you can perhaps give us your interpretation based on your understanding of the issues that have arisen in Otago, and perhaps start at a general level, and then you may be able to discuss any specific examples.
Okay, so I think starting off with lake catchments, there were three catchments in there, or three lakes there that failed to meet the national bottom line in terms of phytoplankton. They were Lake Hayes, Lake Johnson, and Lake Tuakitoto. Those are well-established, well-recognised, degraded water bodies. In the case of Lake Hayes and Lake Johnson, I discuss in my evidence in chief some of the issues behind the degradation of Lake Hayes that's been well documented. Very similar processes in Lake Johnson. It's a shallow-ish lake near Queenstown. I think it's about 30 metres deep, so it's probably not shallow in the sense of some of the truly shallow lakes. You know, intensively farmed catchment, a lot of superphosphate put on the catchment over the years, and well-recognised history of cyanobacteria blooms in that particular lake and Lake Hayes. In the case of Lake Tuakitoto, as is the case with a lot of lowland lakes, you know, it's a very shallow lake. It has had a lot of land clearance in the catchment historically, and sediment inflows into the lake that have exacerbated some of the issues in there. So in terms of the lakes, there wasn't anything that particularly shocked me. For a lot of the attributes, I would note that Otago's lakes were actually in pretty good shape, in most cases in A-band. When you get into the flowing rivers, flowing waters like rivers and streams, largely there were sort of three or four main groups that I pulled out. The first group that there was certainly red flags in terms of not hitting the bottom line were your urban streams. It's again not particularly surprising. That includes Bullock Creek, which flows through the middle of Wanaka. That's probably partly to do with the urban setting, partly to do with the fact that it's groundwater fed, and partly to do with the fact that you've got Didymo on it. So there's the urban streams. There are a few that are lowland catchments, non-irrigated, where land management practices, and particularly around wintering and stock access to waterways, cause issues, particularly around DRP and E. coli and sediment. So those weren't particularly surprising. There were some, like Thompson's Creek, Hills Creek, where they failed on certain attributes, and that was, I would interpret that as being reflecting flood irrigation practices in those catchments. That's pretty well established. And then with reference to the sediment attribute table, a lot of the catchments that fail the national bottom line would do so, in my view, naturally due to active erosion processes. In some cases, the NPSFM does essentially provide an allowance for glacial fair fed rivers. But in some cases, you wouldn't necessarily have glaciation in the catchment, just active mountain topography. But they would still fail that bottom line. So I think in most cases, I could explain the sites that fail to meet bottom lines. But as I say, there are a couple of little curveballs in there. The Makarora River at Makarora, the reason why that would fail E. coli is something that I'd be investigating, particularly with respect to septic tanks in the township and how they might be performing. But other than that, I think largely there weren't any major surprises in there.
Mm. So if we perhaps take a look at a specific example in Thompson's Creek, perhaps jumps out. My understanding that you have been involved in the development of the applications to renew the deemed permits.
Yep, that's correct.
And has that process taken into account the issues that might be giving rise to the non-compliances that we're seeing in these national bottom line reports?
Yes, certainly it has. As Mr. Hickey referred to a couple of days ago now, there is a shift happening in terms of efficiency, technical efficiency of irrigation, away from flood practices towards spray type methods. So that's certainly the sort of thing that I would anticipate leading to an improvement in water quality. And in fact, in a lot of catchments that we look at where you've got a lot of historical flood irrigation and progressive conversion to spray, we actually see a lot of positive trends in particularly phosphorus and sediment, not necessarily in E. coli because that's a little bit more variable, but certainly in terms of phosphorus and sediment, which is what you'd expect with that wipe-off water, that excess water that's been irrigated onto the paddocks, often being discharged back into the river. And I agree with what Mr. Hickey said about the rules that were intended to be in 6A, Plan Change 6A, to deal with the water quality consequences of those sort of, essentially their point source discharges, that was the intent, was to kind of knock the obvious ones of those on the head. And I would anticipate that would result in an improvement in water quality in those catchments with a dominance of flood irrigation.
Do you have anything else? Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honour. Just while we're there, staying on this theme of the conversion to spray irrigation, What have there been underlying or changes to the underlying land uses associated with the change to spray irrigation?
Certainly in some cases there's intensification associated with conversion to spray. In some cases there has been an expansion of area. I've certainly seen both of those instances in my sort of travels.
And you mentioned that there have been some improvements in relation to some contaminants as a result of that change, and you noted changes in terms of DRP, so the types of contaminants that would have been, I think your words, wiped off the surface as that floodwater moved through?
So, yeah, wipe off water, that's actually a technical term. So irrigators often have, so they have bywashes, which is where water's bypassed out of the race and over into somewhere, might be onto the paddock. Wipe off water is essentially the technical term for that excess water that has been irrigated on a paddock, and anything that's left over, that is essentially, they open the gate at the end of the run of irrigation, particularly on board a dike, they open the gate and that water discharges back in, and usually into a water body or a race.
One contaminant that you didn't mention was nitrogen. So are you observing any changes in relation to nitrogen with the shift to spray irrigation?
Absolutely. So nitrogen, typically what we see in those catchments where we see improvements in DRP and sediment is associated with that shift, as you point out. We often see an increasing trend in nitrogen. Now, in part, I think there's a couple of things going on there. A lot of our freshwaters in Otago are phosphorus limited. So I personally, in terms of effects, particularly on periphyton, I'm typically more concerned about phosphorus because it's a limiting nutrient. An increasing trend in nitrogen can arise from that, essentially that technical conversion from spray from flood to spray means that there is less water percolating through the soil profile and into groundwater. And what that means, in a practical sort of respect, is that there's less water to dilute nitrogen. So quite often when you look at a conversion like that, you actually see a decline in the load of nitrogen going on. That's as predicted by Overseer. But because there's less water going through the soil profile and diluting that nitrogen in groundwater, that has the effect of actually raising the concentration of nitrogen. And then if that discharges to the surface water body, which it often does, we end up seeing this enrichment of nitrogen at that point in the surface water.
And my understanding is that the current planning framework doesn't deal with that effect.
No. Plan Change 6A did have a permitted activity threshold for nitrogen, and that varied depending on where you were in the region. I guess that I'd characterise that as a first stab at dealing with that issue. While I was at Regional Council, we had active projects, research projects in the Kākanui, the Shag, and the Ettrick aquifer that were directly targeted at determining what that threshold should be to try and, or possibly there might need to be a change in approach in those catchments to try and manage that effect. I'm also aware that in the lower Waitaki, on the Waitaki Plains, the Otago part of the Waitaki, that there was concern about the shift from flood to spray, and particularly regarding the dilution that the flood irrigation was doing in the aquifer, and we were concerned that nitrate levels were going to start to get up to sort of dangerous or concerning levels in some of the local supply bores.
Except that there's a connection between the use of water and water quality and receiving water bodies?
Yes, but that relationship isn't necessarily straightforward.
In fact, you'd accept that that relationship can be quite complicated.
Absolutely.
And when you think about the types of rules that are required to manage that relationship, those rules can be quite complex too.
They can be. I think with... I think it depends on the nature of the problem that you're trying to fix.
Are you familiar with other planning frameworks? And let's pick the neighbour to the North, Canterbury, in terms of the complexity of that planning framework. If you had any dealings with that?
Yeah, I have had some dealings with that.
And when you think about complex planning frameworks trying to address this issue in terms of the connectivity between land use and water quality. Is that perhaps a good example of the complexity of the rules required?
Oh, I'd certainly agree that Canterbury's rules are complex. I'm not a planner, so I don't have any opinion on whether that complexity is actually what's required.
So when you think about the science that you say is readily available for the Otago Regional Council to inform its new planning framework, is it fair to say that you are confident that the science is there to inform the planning framework that will deal with these complexities?
I think where it requires complexity, and those examples I gave before are good examples of that. I mean, we spent a considerable sum of money and time in the Kakanui and the Shag to address those issues. So in the catchments where I see a burning need to deal with it, I think that there is actually a considerable body of information. And some of the other parts of Otago where maybe it's not quite such a high priority, I think that, yeah, possibly in the future additional work may be required, but I think that's it's on a needs basis.
So you'd be confident that there is sufficient scientific information to meet the deadline of December 2023 for the new land and water plan?
So I haven't been in council for about 3 years, so I'm not entirely sure as to what work program has been delivered since I left. I think that there is enough information in the areas where nitrogen is a particular issue. I think that there is. The only caveat I'd put around that would be the large alpine lakes. And in the development of the long-term plan, so the one that they're currently using, in the development of that, I had a lot of work focused on those alpine lakes, trying to establish sustainable load of nitrogen to the lakes. I'm not sure if that work's been done or not. I've been kind of keeping an ear out for it, but I haven't seen anything come out of that. That would probably be my single biggest concern. If that work hadn't been delivered, as per what I scheduled in for the LTP, then I would say that would be a deficiency. But other than that, the hot spots that we knew about in terms of nitrogen, concerning levels of nitrogen, I think we've got them pretty well covered.
So your evidence is that you say there is sufficient scientific basis for identifying freshwater values for most of the key water bodies in Otago. So when you think about, and when you use the word values in that context, which values do you have in mind?
So values I'm talking about ecological in-stream values. I recognise that there are other values, such as cultural values. I'm not referring to cultural values.
So you're staying within your ecological box, so to speak, when you're using the reference to freshwater values
Yes, to a large extent. I'm also aware of work that's been done in, for example, the Arrow and the Manuhurakea around recreational assessments. So I'm aware of that work having been done, and those are certainly values that, you know, I'm known to partake in every now and then.
And there's some significant work that is currently underway in terms of understanding the cultural values of importance in the region?
I'm sure there is, but I don't have an opinion. I'm not going to offer an opinion on that. Not directly familiar with it, other than I'm aware that it's happening.
And so when we think about the new land and water plan, one of the challenges there is making sure that the full range of values have been assessed such that the new framework can be put together to appropriately respond to and address those values. And the scientific work is but one of the components in terms of the information required for that process.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when it comes then to setting the limits in that plan and the limits that will apply to ensure that the values are maintained and protected, it's important that those values assessments have been completed.
Yep.
It's not just a matter of responding to or inserting ecological limits at this point in time.
No, not when it comes to the whole of the plan.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Winchester.
Moore's covered all my questions, ma'am. Thank you.
Ms. Williams.
Your Honour, I don't have any questions.
Ms. Becky Galloway.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hello. Meet again.
Just want to take you to your page 2 in your summary.
Oh, yeah. Just got to find it. Yeah, there we go.
And you've got your second last bullet point from the bottom. Minimum flows and residual flows are the key tools to protect in-stream values from the effects of water abstraction. I just want to be clear that whilst in the middle bullet point, you refer to a range of other factors affecting ecosystem health, such as pest species like didymo and introduced species like trout, you're not saying that the presence of those other factors affecting ecosystem health should defer setting appropriate minimum or residual flows, are you?
Sorry, can you rephrase that? I'm just not quite
just
sure.
Just because there are other features present that are affecting the ecosystem health, that's not a reason to defer setting appropriate minimum or residual flows, is it?
No, that's correct. I'm answering that in a negative and a positive way. Yes, I agree that it's not a reason to delay.
Thank you. And have you read Dr. Hayes' evidence?
I have.
Have you got that handy?
I have.
So if you can turn to page 9, paragraph 24.
Yep.
So Dr. Hayes says, along with the magnitude of the minimum flow, the allocation rate, which influences the frequency and duration of occurrence of the minimum flow, also has ecological effects. Do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do. But I would say that in the case of what we're talking about here, so in deemed permit catchments, where you have distributed takes throughout a drainage network, so it's not just one big dam that's taking all the water out at one point. So looking at their distributed takes across a drainage network and in with those takes being primarily run of river, I don't think that the allocation limit has as significant effect as the minimum or residual flows. because any individual take on a tributary is not going to be taking all the water at that point, or the, you know, it won't necessarily be proportional to the total allocation within the catchment. So there's that aspect. Runner River takes as well. I mean, there's often times when people will not be taking at their full rate. You know, it might have just rained, so you know, you might be at field capacity, so you wouldn't be irrigating under those circumstances. So yeah, this sort of theoretical effect of an allocation rate written into a plan is that it draws the recession of a flood down to your minimum flow, and the higher the allocation is proportionally to the size of the river, the faster that happens. That's really the case, because usually...
Not really.
It is not often the case in this kind of system, because what you often have is you have a high flow event where it's just rained heaps. There's oodles of water. Often, you know, the farmers have too much water. It's the old classic, you know, there's always too much water or not enough. So they're not necessarily going to be taking on that recession to steepen it by as much as theoretically would be possible. And if you model assuming maximum rate of take at all times, you'll overestimate the effectiveness of allocation rate on hydrology and therefore the ecology in these circumstances.
So your all of that answer after your initial answer was you were having a specific catchment. You've got the Manuhirikia in mind when you're answering that question.
Think all of the deemed permit catchments would fit in that same sort of, be cut from similar cloth. So no, it was a general observation, particularly in places like Central. So often in early season you have quite a lot of water available, and Otago being Otago, you've quite often got crappy weather, so there might not be that much demand in that early part of the season, and it's so people won't necessarily be taking their full allocation. So that's sort of what I'm getting at is the allocation rate, yes, it does have an effect at times, but it's not, as in my view, as important as the magnitude of the minimum flow or the residual flow.
And that's consistent, I think, with paragraph 26 of Dr. Hayes' evidence there, the second sentence. The likelihood of adverse ecological effects increases unless the minimum flow has been set high enough to maintain a high proportion of benthic invertebrate productivity, drift transport capacity and growth benefits for fish. So you'd agree with that statement?
I don't entirely agree with that statement. Dr. Hayes and I worked together for a number of years, and part of that, as part of that, we developed a model called, excuse the bad acronym, but HABSIM. So sort of going along with the RIHABSIM sort of acronym. So BIT-HABSIM was a benthic invertebrate time series habitat model. I think that's what it stands for, or habitat simulation. So essentially what that model does is it takes into account the effects of flooding, because floods are destructive, right, particularly for macroinvertebrates. So when you're talking about the benthic invertebrate productivity, the benthic invertebrates, every time a flood comes through, it kills some of them. So that's through sandblasting, that's through them being buried under fine sediment and that sort of thing. So it's been sort of recognised in the literature, people have referred to it as, you know, rivers are essentially, the benthic communities are in a constant state of recovery from the last flood. And that's part of what I did my PhD on in the Kyburn. Dr. Hayes and I had a lot of discussions around benthic invertebrates and the drivers of their productivity, and throw our minds back to the wire hour and the like. And so we developed this model to take into account preceding floods, because I was never entirely comfortable with just sticking them into a habitat model and saying this is the magic number, because it doesn't really work like that. So the closer you are to a flood, the community is going to be reduced well below what its carrying capacity is. Now, all these sort of models, habitat models, assume essentially that you're limited by habitat availability. And what I'm saying is I don't agree with that statement in Dr. Hayes's evidence, because he gets into Habsham a little bit later, because particularly late, like just after floods and earlier in the season, those invertebrate communities are going to be well below carrying capacity, and actually the amount of flow that you're providing isn't necessarily going to give you this big boost in benthic productivity. These invertebrates live for between 6 months and a year, so they don't just recover like overnight. It can take several weeks.
Mm. And so can I suggest that rather than you saying you don't agree with Dr. Hayes' statement, is that your agreement is you qualify your agreement, you know, subject to the effects of the flood pattern?
High flows. Yeah, so I certainly agree with the point he's making around drift transport, and I agree with the growth benefits for fish that come from that drift transport, but the benthic production part. So if you have a river that's flooding two or three times a year, chances are the biomass of bugs is never going to reach peak biomass. And when you
no matter what your minimum flow is, that's your point. Okay, that's good. I understand that. Now, just want to move on to your paragraph 45.
Sorry, this is my paragraph 45.
Your paragraph 45.
Yeah.
Where you've got a section on longfin eels.
Yep.
And so longfin eels, they're not a threatened species. They're in the at-risk category, aren't they? So they're down.
Yeah. So the latest threat classification by DOC. This is the Dunn et al. Guidelines, 2018, has a special section on longfin eels, and it says that they're maintained as being at risk declining, but recent data suggests that the abundance of longfin eel may be stable or increasing in commercial fisheries. So they've kept them as at risk declining, but actually the data that's coming back is kind of indicating that things might not be as dire as maybe we thought they were about 5 years or so ago.
Does that reference to commercial fisheries, is that a spatial thing? Like, is the Clutha catchment a commercial fishery? Do you know?
I'm sure there is commercial eeling in the lower Clutha.
Do you
Clutha.
Know?
I don't have direct knowledge of that, but I have indirect knowledge.
Yeah.
There's references to commercial fishers catching eels for contact energy from the lower Clutha and transporting them up into the dams. So I presume that those commercial fishers fish the lower Clutha.
Okay.
I can't see why they wouldn't.
We also heard from Ms. McIntyre that they're also Mahinga Kai species.
Yep.
So in that sense, they're relevant to that that compulsory value in the National Policy Statement Appendix A1.
Absolutely.
So given that they're relevant to that compulsory value, regardless of the time it's going to take for that for context trap and transfer mitigation to have the I think it's at paragraph 48. You say it's the biomass and numbers of fish are low, and then you say until in your paragraph 50 you say until upstream passage issues past these dams are fully addressed, I expect this will remain the case, which is that that you know their presence is low, the biomass is low.
As a result of the
as
dams.
As a result.
Yeah.
Given their significance, though, as a Mahinga Kai species and a compulsory value, that's not a reason to not properly provide for their habitat requirements in those catchments, is it?
No.
No. Okay, thank you, Ma'am. No further questions.
Thank you. Forest and Bird are meant to be here, but they're not here. Representative's not here, so we're just moving straight to re-examination. None. Okay, have you got any questions, Commissioner?
I just had one question, and it was in relation to the new land and water plan that needs to be prepared in order to give effect to the MPS for freshwater management. And so there's been a lot of discussion about attributes and values and things that have to happen, but clearly contaminants and water quality is a big part of that as well. So would you see a need to progress developing up limits in order to ensure that those attributes and values are addressed? And that is an urgent requirement?
Yes. The NPSFM includes the National Objectives Framework. I mean, that's probably in my sort of area. That's the part of the NPS I probably that pour over the
no,
most
because, sure.
You know, people want to know where we stand in terms of the tables. And that sets very clear expectations. In terms of, I know there's been quite a lot of controversy about nitrogen and phosphorus being included or not included in those tables. Nitrate is currently only included as a toxin, so in terms of toxic effects rather than enrichment effects. That's been quite controversial, but I guess for me the periphyton attribute around periphyton biomass is the ultimate gauge of whether or not you're achieving the outcome that you're seeking by managing nitrogen. So if you're within the bands that you set for the particular water body you're working in for periphyton biomass, then that to me says that you're managing the nutrients that would give rise to nuisance periphyton appropriately. Obviously the toxic effects are there and they're certainly important. As I said, a lot of our rivers are phosphorus limited, so managing nitrate aggressively in them isn't necessarily going to allow you to manage the biomass, the periphyton biomass, because it's not that, you know, it's phosphorus that's driving that in a lot of those systems a lot of the time, rather than nitrate alone.
So I did ask Mr. Hickey a question because he was talking quite a lot about the work that he had been doing in individual catchments on a voluntary basis and looking at, I guess, the implications of various regimes and all the rest of it in the water-taking context. And when I asked him about the quality side of the equation, he said that was something that you were addressing.
That's right.
So is that the kind of work that you're taking on and as a complementary part of the work that Mr. Hickey is doing?
Yeah. So that.
So
I
could
mean,
you give me an example of that?
In part of the assessment of effects, describing the existing state of the environment, assessing it against the limits in the plan or the targets in the plan, and also against the NPSFM. So that's typically been part of my role. And then really, I guess, assessing that in terms of the risk, ecological risk, so things, potential effects on periphyton, E. coli bathing risk, that sort of thing, and then input into some of the means of mitigating that. So certainly had very robust discussions around fencing, environmental management plans for farms, and certainly the conversion to spray tends to be a bit of a given in a lot of these catchments because of the emphasis that the current water plan has on technical efficiency. So they're essentially they're going to have to convert away from systems like contour flood or border dike. The plan clearly pushes them away from that towards spray anyway. So that has as I articulated before, that a bunch of positive effects arising from that, because you don't have that overland flow bringing contaminants off the paddocks straight into the water bodies.
So that would be quite a lot of work for the whole catchment.
Yeah.
And a lot of the, there are permits that aren't approaching consenting.
Yeah.
So how do you basically then deal with this on a whole of catchment basis?
Yeah, so my role at ORC, when I was there, we were trying to put together the work program to deliver that. That was back in 2018. Well, sorry, that was the start of the LTP cycle. So it was in 2017 that we were doing a lot of the groundwork to try and make that plan. There were certainly some areas. It really depends a little bit on what the issues are. So as I mentioned before, the glacial lakes, so Lake Hawea, Wakatipu and Wanaka, it was modelling in the lake itself to try and address what the sustainable nutrient load would be, and then a contemporary estimate of current land use inputs into the lake and loads from major tributaries into the lakes and from urban areas as well, because that's part of it, particularly in places like Queenstown Bay and the Frankton Arm. And so that work sort of in totality would allow you to essentially create a budget, a contaminant budget for the lake, and you would be comparing essentially contemporary inputs of nutrients versus what the lake can assimilate. And based on that, that would then flow through to policy development rules associated to try and manage any issues where that arises.
So you would envisage that would happen through the land and water plan to come?
I would envisage that now. The plan that I had in mind when I was developing it was that it would possibly go into a plan change. We didn't get very... I was delivering the technical work, so that's sort of one step in the process. So my view of it was that the work that we were doing in the Kākanui and the Shag and possibly Ettrick and the glacial lakes, if required, would possibly form a plan change to try and address any concerns that we might have. So that was the original plan, but obviously, you know, with recent developments and the Minister's interest, there's been a movement towards, and the latest NPSFM, there's been a movement towards the whole plan redevelopment or renewal.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, I just referred to Dr. Everett Hinks. She provided a statement of evidence in reply. Have you got that there?
I have.
I just wondered if you could comment on, well, particularly at para 14, where she talks about the difference between data and conclusions about significance and so on.
Yeah, so I think I disagree with Dr. Everett Hinks's point in that paragraph, as I understand it. I think that certainly in my experience, a lot of the issues, water quality issues in Otago, are actually pretty well understood. It's been long recognised that South Otago has issues with winter management, you know, stock access to waterways, all that sort of basic land management sort of issues, and effluent management. And then in North Otago, areas covered by the North Otago Irrigation Scheme, you've essentially got Waitaki water coming over and providing extra water in a catchment that has been historically been very water short. And that's created, I guess, some issues, and we certainly did quite a lot of work on nitrogen enrichment in there, and I think we understood the drivers of that quite well. I think it's not necessarily captured in a document that I could easily put my hand on, but the knowledge within the walls, the staff who were there and who are there, you know, generally if you pulled out one of these numbers in Dr. Snelder's table and said, you know, what do you think's going on here, they'd be able to tell you. It's sometimes it would be an easy answer, other times it might be quite a challenging answer.
So do you have a comment, you know, because obviously Dr. Everett Hanks has given evidence about quite a significant scientific investigation, collection, information program that's being planned and put in place in the council. Have you got comment on the efficacy of doing that in relation to your understanding?
Yeah, I think, obviously I haven't been in council for 3 years, so I'm sure there's conversations happening in terms of policy need and the work program, the science work program that's required to address that policy need. In my view, based on my knowledge where we were sitting in terms of when I was at regional council, there's always more information is always helpful, but whether or not it's necessary, if you understand the key drivers, then I think you can get a long way towards having the desired outcome. Notwithstanding the fact that the NPSFM, there's the process around the FMUs and the value setting, I fully recognise that was a new work program and that comes with substantial resourcing requirements, particularly in the policy space, to, you know, go and talk to the community about their visions and their aspirations and their values. But in terms of the scientific work, I think the values are well understood.
Well, it might be understood, but is the information available?
The information is available. Yeah, I think it is.
Okay, well, thank you.
You touched on Plan Change 6, which I understand is now an operative.
Well, it's been paused.
It's been what?
My understanding is it's been delayed. The rules that were meant to come into effect, I think, last year, have been pushed out.
I think, and I might be wrong because I haven't sat down and studied it, but one of those rules were around nutrient budgeting. Is that right?
There was a permitted activity threshold for nitrogen that required overseer, and you could farm essentially without a consent if you stayed within the permitted activity threshold for that particular area. Mm. But if you wanted to, you could apply for consent to discharge more than that threshold, of course requiring an assessment to back that up.
And that threshold for nitrogen, was that a numeric limit or something else?
Yeah, it was a numeric limit as a load calculated by overseer, and there was a certain version of overseer named in the plan. Depending on what area you were in, it could vary between, I believe it was 10 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year, mm-hmm. and 30.
Mm. So why did the council push pause on that?
I can't answer that. You'd have to ask someone from council, possibly a politician.
A politician. And I ask you that because it's your evidence that there is a lot of data, facts and information which the council has available now. And then the choice, I suspect, and you're nodding for the transcript, the witness is nodding. And the choice is, I suspect, do you use that information that is available to either inform the land and water plan whilst pushing pause to further expansion water takes and land uses associated with water takes. This is a particular reference to the primary sector. So do you use the available information to inform a plan, a new plan, or do you use the information to inform a resource consent? I mean, that's the choice, isn't it? You say the information's available, so which choice does the should the court go down is really what this case is about. Or is that a too crude a summary of what this case is about?
Well, too much information can actually paralyse.
Oh, I know that too.
Policy yeah. development. you get all this stuff, and you just go, "Well, what the hell do we make of that?" Yeah. Whereas, I think the elegance of Plan Change 6A was really that it took quite a simple view on it, with the view that it was a limit that was applying soon. And I had a lot of conversation with colleagues from particularly other regions who were saying, you guys, you know, this isn't going to work, you know, you got your numbers wrong, whatever. And my response to them was predominantly, well, at least we have numbers in the plan and we're signalling to the community direction. And some of those colleagues who were in other regions didn't. And in that 5 years between us having that, we got 6A over the line and when those rules were coming in, they had further degradation. So I think sometimes it's just best to put, you might not have perfect information, you're never going to have perfect information. You put your best foot forward on the basis of the knowledge that you have and you set your plan up around that. And if you realise in 10 years' time, presumably when you do your plan effectiveness review, you realise that that didn't work. One of the challenges with doing that plan effectiveness monitoring in Otago is that deemed permits have not been subject to any of the policies in the plan. So that you go out and monitor and you don't know whether, once you renew these permits, whether that's actually going to be the effect of them or not. Because essentially, your policies haven't had full effect yet. So it's tempting to jump off the deep end and go and do a whole bunch of science, and, you know, I'm a scientist, that's my bread and butter, I love it, but it's not necessarily going to get you to a better endpoint in terms of policy, in my experience.
So your view, the Regional Council has the information that it needs now, either to get on with its land and water plan, or alternatively, as is requested by many parties, not just IRUG, but many parties, decide water permit renewals on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
So that's a choice.
Yeah.
Yep, okay. All right, that's all my questions. I think it's us. So anything arising from that? Nothing. Okay, thank you very much for your evidence.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's good. So that's us for today. and then through to Ms. Dicey tomorrow. And is only Ms. Dicey on tomorrow? Probably.
Well, I think that probably is a question for my friends, but I think so.
Probably. Ms. Dicey's at the back. Yes, looking at the cross-examination, that's true.
She's been waiting for tomorrow.
Yeah, okay, so Ms. Dicey's the only witness tomorrow, and then after cross-examination's finished, we'll rise and then start sitting in Cromwell.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just have one matter I'd like to raise.
Yes, you've got a witness who hasn't written the evidence or submitted. It's going to be delayed or late.
Well, yes, so it's Matthew Tooze, who's the planner for the territorial authorities. And I think the direction previously was that any supplementary evidence from him was to be filed tomorrow.
Yeah.
He has been endeavouring to keep up with the audio recordings and the conversations that have happened with the various planners. It has proved a little challenging for him. And he has asked if he can have a bit more time to think through that a bit more carefully before he puts together his supplementary evidence. And so I'm asking on his behalf if he can file that supplementary brief a bit later.
What could he be responding to, do you think? I mean, I know he said he couldn't, I'm not going to take it back, but what do you think he's responding to? Because we know that he's about to participate in that expert conference as well for territorials?
Yes, yeah. So he's participating in two conferences, yeah. I believe, the conference next week and the schedule, mm-hmm. and then he'll be participating in the planning
General
conference.
Planning. Yeah.
He was anticipating addressing, obviously, the change in position from the council, but also the sort of follow-on changes that have come through and suggestions from the likes of Mr. Ensor, which has specifically dealt with the community supply issues. And I think when I was speaking with him this morning, he has perhaps reflected on the challenges that arise. Mr. Ensor was a good example of trying to rush redrafting and that the issues that that can create. And given that the territorial authorities are not to be heard, being heard in Cromwell, that was there a possibility of him having some more time to think carefully about any further amendments that he might suggest in response to the various iterations that we've seen over the last 3 weeks?
I'll think about that and come back to you tomorrow morning.
Okay.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. Mr. Moore.
Tomorrow and Ms. Dicey, I'm cognizant that I had sought 45 minutes for my cross-examination of that witness.
Do you want longer?
That might be a little bit light in light of the experience of Mr. Ensor. Ms. Dicey similarly has gone to the trouble of actually producing some provisions, which is helpful, but in terms of testing those to really understand them, I might need a little extra time.
That's okay. No, I anticipated 45 minutes might be a bit light, actually. And 45 minutes is, I guess, fair enough for the first round, but now we've got quite a different round, and so the issues grow or change. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's fine, about an hour or a bit more. I don't know how long you were with Mr. Ensor.
It was a couple of hours in the end.
Really?
that's why I'm raising the issue. I'll be as efficient as I can, but it's important we do examine the words.
Okay. That's all right. Mr. Cooper, is it? 2 hours? Okay. Yeah, he's controlling me, you see, with the schedule. All right, no, that's fine. Anybody else? No, okay. All right, I'll think about that overnight. The only question I have about your witness is, what is he responding to, given that we've got this, this other expert conferencing process coming in.
Yeah, I mean, if your preference is he doesn't file supplementary and we wait for the conferences to occur and he addresses anything that arises from the conferencing and we reconvene, then that would be fine.
How did the witness for Trustpower deal with it? She's already filed, hasn't she?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, she has. Okay. All right, we'll think about that and come back to you overnight in the morning.
Thank you.
Okay. And we're adjourned. All rise.